The first shot in the anti-league campaign, which I referred to in the last address, was actually fired not by the communists, which would have been understandable, but by Izzy Liebler, one of the rising leaders of the Zionist Jewish group, which has, of course, international implications. In fact, as we follow the campaign by the Zionist Jewish group against the League, we reach several stages where Mr. Liebler bluntly stated that the League had to be driven from the Australian political stage. It must not be allowed to have any place whatever. It was quite clear what his intentions were. Now, one of the books that's been used in the long campaign against the League, generally, and of course against me personally, is a book that I wrote at the end of the Second World War called The International Jew. The International Jew was a commentary on those documents generally known as the Protocols. In that book, I pointed out that the origins of these documents had never been properly authenticated, but it was clear that they embodied thinking that went back over a long period of time. In that book, The International Jew, I also quoted a number of very prominent Jewish authorities who dealt with the tremendous Jewish influence in human history. One of the most famous of these being Dr. Oscar Levy, a well-known literary figure, who in one of his works stated that the Jewish question went right to the core of the human drama and must be faced by all honest inquirers. He also said much else about 2,000 years of what he described as Talmudic madness. The concept of a chosen group having dominance over all other groups. The International Jew was published in a hurry. It was published straight after the war and on very cheap newsprint, and was published in South Australia. 10,000 copies were run. The presses had to be held up for a short period of time because the printer suddenly took fright and required me, before he would proceed to give an undertaking which my lawyer suggested we should not do at all. So that's the start of The International Jew. Looking back on it today, there's nothing that's not known today. The subject's been widely canvassed. Many debates have taken place. And whatever conclusions you come to concerning these documents, there's no argument that whoever put them together had a tremendous insight into the human drama and how human affairs operate. Now, in the initial stages, when The International Jew was readily available, there was hardly any reference to it anywhere. It was only when the League of Rights started to become a force and The International Jew was rather difficult to obtain that we started to hear all sorts of allegations about The International Jew and Eric Butler. Most of the allegations quite false, and many of the quotations out of context, or some of them deliberately manufactured. Perhaps I might say at this stage, as we'll be coming back to it later, I did stress the tremendous importance between the Christian concept of individual responsibility, the divinity of each individual, and the Pharisaical concept of the individual belonging to some chosen group. And as we'll see, this is one of the major battlegrounds that's taken place over the years, and in fact will certainly decide the future of civilization. So it is important to remember that the international Jew was hardly discussed until the League of Rights started to emerge as a major political force. And of course the main charge against the League was because it stressed that communism was a movement which from the beginning, and still was, relying upon the backing of the international money power, we might use that general term at this stage, that no real discussion of the communist question could take place unless this question was dealt with. The great Oswald Spengler, in his tremendous classic, The Decline of the West, observed that no revolutionary movement in history, including communism, had taken place without the backing of money power. Revolution was impossible without money power. In putting this view forward, of course, the League was touching clearly a very raw nerve. And this explains the ongoing campaign concerning the League in this area. Allegations of what's called anti-Semitism, a quite absurd statement, quite meaningless, drained of any real meaning, as the great Alexander Solzhenitsyn pointed out, whose only crime was in his writings on the gulags in the Soviet, listed the major labor bosses controlling the gulags. They all happened to be prominent Jews. He didn't labor that point, he merely listed the fact. This was allegedly evidence of his anti-Semitism. So the term anti-Semitism, of course, has been part of the ongoing propaganda campaign. It still is today. In many cases, it's used by quite shallow journalists and others who simply don't know any better, or it's used by others as part of psycho-political warfare. In 1958, I was prominent in local government, and I was standing that year and was, according to the tradition of my local council, the Eltham Council, to become the Shire President. A tremendous campaign was unleashed against me in an attempt to prevent my election, and in the course of this we saw the first signs of that type of campaign that's continued ever since. We needn't dwell on that at this moment. It's only part of the historical background. Then we come to 1959. In 1959, I was a member of the Melbourne Anglican Synod. At the Synod in 1958, I had caused somewhat of a stir by raising the question of Christian education and church schools. And the matter was widely discussed in the media at that time. And that was a very significant event. But in 1959, I had a resolution put forward that Christianity and communism philosophically were completely incompatible. That resolution went forward on the notice paper and caused a tremendous stir, so much so that the Archbishop, Dr. Frank Woods, got in touch with me and hoped that in moving this resolution, we would not have the type of public debate that we had the previous year concerning education. I raised the question with his grace, perhaps he would like me to withdraw the resolution, which I pointed out had the backing of some rather prominent churchmen. Now, he didn't want that, but nevertheless, he obviously was very, very nervous about the whole situation and had been subjected to a tremendous campaign. In fact, the background of this campaign can be found in a journal now extinct called Nation, fortnightly Sydney publication, which in September of that year came out with the rather startling headlines, "The Secret Life of Eric Butler." And of course, that had been brought to the attention of Dr. Frank Woods. And I might say that every member of the Melbourne Anglican Synod was supplied with a copy of that article. This was merely a rehash of some of the earlier attacks on the League. And amongst those who were attacked was the vicar of St. Mark's at that time, the Reverend Norman Hill, who had become a close colleague of mine and very much involved in the anti-communist cause. The debate itself attracted widespread public comment. In fact, so much so that the debate during the afternoon was adjourned until some type of a compromise, so it was put, could be worked out during the dinner recess before the evening session, where the matter would have to be finalized. It was at that stage that an event took place which has not been publicised, and that is that Sir Reginald Scholl, who was also a member of the Synod and spokes in support of my resolution, quietly took the members of the committee aside at the dinner recess and said that he had a personal message from no less a person than Sir Edmund Herring. And Sir Edmund Herring wanted to be known that he wanted this resolution carried. That was the decisive moment, I think, in the debate, which then proceeded after the recess. And Mr. Justice Scholl spoke. It was very interesting in the debate that took place. It was generally the layman that supported my view. Those that spoke against the resolution were what we might call members of the pink clergy or the left-wing clergy, and some remarkable statements were made in the course of the debate by one prominent gentleman who said that communism must be all right because the communists got rid of all the flies in China. Other developments associated with this debate must be commented upon. Although the resolution was carried, the papers in Melbourne, particularly the Age, were inundated with letters, most of them anti the League of Rights and anti Eric Butler. And prominent amongst those was a man who later was accepted by some who should have known better as a very prominent anti-communist, Dr. Frank Knoppelmacher, a senior lecturer in political science at the Melbourne University, along with several others. In essence, what Dr. Knoppelmacher was saying was that Eric Butler had every right to propose a resolution opposing communism. But in essence, the work of the League of Rights was counterproductive, in fact, was being exploited by the communists and denigrating the true work of communists, anti-communists like himself. Knoppelmacher himself had been, in his youth, a prominent member of the Communist Party, but had left it, and I've never doubted his genuine opposition to the harsher features of communism. But never once did Dr. Knoppelmacher and others of his ilk touched this question of the financing of communism. That was a subject which was forbidden and the League of Rights in raising the question was quite out of bounds. So here you can see where we were reaching. We were touching a very, very raw nerve in the political debate. We move forward from there, and while, of course, there was enormous documentation concerning the early financing of the Bolshevik Revolution by the great international bankers, and much else, it was only when a top academic at the prestigious Stanford University in Los Angeles, Dr. Sutton, came forward that we had the overwhelming case which had never before been previously put. Dr. Sutton, in his studies, thoroughly documented the fact that from the beginning, the Bolsheviks had been financed and economically sustained by the West. Chapter and verse were provided. Now, his first published study at Stanford University did not create much interest except among specialists who study these matters. It wasn't a popular sort of a thesis, wasn't in popular publication, it was a specialist work. Nevertheless, it did attract the attention of a few people of importance, particularly some members of the Republican Party. So much so that at the 1972 Miami Beach Republican Party conference, one of the sections of the party invited Dr. Sutton to make a presentation. It was perhaps one of the most dramatic that's ever been presented to a major political party in modern times. Now, let us remember, at this time, the Vietnam War was still raging. Great controversy right around the world. Great controversy inside the United States. And it should be recorded, not without significance, the major media in the United States, all controlled by international banking groups or Zionist Jewish groups, was anti-Vietnam. So much so was this a feature of the campaign that at one stage President Lyndon Johnson called in some of the leading rabbis to discuss the question. He was so concerned about what was taking place. So Dr. Sutton's giving his evidence, very short, not many minutes, but most dramatic in that in the middle of the Vietnam War, here's this scientist documenting the fact that the war was only being sustained by the Soviet being permitted to send a tremendous flood, a continuing flood of production into North Vietnam through the port of Haiphong. And he documented the most amazing fact of all, that most of the Soviet equipment was being carried in ships that had been built by the West. In other words, he summarized by saying, we have Americans being killed in Vietnam by Soviet equipment which the West is building, particularly the United States. I later discussed this remarkable event with one of the Republican congressman who had been present, and he said it was a most dramatic moment at the finish of Dr. Sutton's evidence. And you might have thought, he said, that a patriotic party would immediately say, well, this matter's got to be widely publicized, we've got to take a stand if we're really going to be genuine in this campaign. But he said the general reaction was, when they got over the initial shock, was if this news gets out and is widely publicized, Richard Nixon could lose the elections, which gives you some insight into modern politics. I might say that the three major wire services in the United States covered the Miami conference were present. The text of Dr. Sutton's evidence was given to them, and not one of those wire services carried that evidence. The American public were left in the dark. It remained for individual groups here and there to try and publicize what in essence was, as Dr. Sutton said in his book, a type of national suicide. Not only was the United States committing suicide, the Western world was committing suicide. At that stage, the League of Rights was the only movement in Australia that was featuring this. The League of Rights said, yes, we've got to stop the expansion of communism in Asia, often quoting what had happened in the Korean campaign, where Douglas MacArthur was forced to curtail the campaign by pressure. He made that famous statement, if we don't win here, where we can win, we'll simply fight this all over again in some other part of Asia. And this was now taking place in Vietnam. So while we had the conventional anti-communists all saying we had to support the anti-communist campaign against Vietnam, the League was the only movement in this country that was drawing attention to the fact we were virtually fighting, not only with our hands behind our backs, but we were fighting against people that were being supplied with equipment from the West itself, particularly from the United States. That stage, the League of Rights did something that should be recorded. It was already, of course, expanding its circulation of literature, important literature. And so in 1973, the League took one of its first major steps in this field by publishing an Australian edition, with the permission of Dr. Sutton, of National Suicide. It's quite a classic. It should be read again today. Made a tremendous contribution at that time, except again that most of the so-called anti-communists didn't want to know about it. But there it was. Dr. Sutton went on and explains that it was after he'd published National Suicide that his academic career at Stanford University came to an end overnight. In fact, so suddenly that one day he was a eminent research director, and the next day it was past tense he had been. He put it, I became a non-person. And even there at Stanford University, he found that some of these so-called prominent anti-communists shunned him completely. They did not want to hear this type of news. Dr. Sutton went on, of course, later and produced another documented work, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, which was the first documented history of the actual facts concerning the financing, how it was done, the tremendous organization, and how the Soviet Union would never, in its early stages, been able to survive without that support. By this time, of course, he had been completely ostracized in the academic world, quite outside the pale, and he continued to go outside the pale when he added to those first two books with a third book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, in which he showed that Hitler also had been financed by the same type of groups, which brought out the fact that real history is really not a series of disconnected episodes, but there is a continuity, if you can pick it up in history, a continuity. C.H. Douglas made reference to this question once when he said that written history was always suspect because most of it was merely the opinion of those that wrote the history. And real history could no more be written than you could describe a spring morning. Real history, as he put it, was what he called crystallized politics. And if you could pick up a theme in history and show that power was being exercised in a certain direction over a long period of time, then you could say, of course, that there was a long-term strategy growing out of a philosophy which had a vision of a future. Now, this raises another question, which, of course, has been associated with the campaign against the League, and that is that the League of Rights is one of those strange organizations that believes in what's called the conspiracy theory of history. I agree the word conspiracy does raise certain emotional factors with many people, but again, as Douglas said, we've got to be quite clear about history. Either history is shaped by disconnected episodes, what some have described as the village idiot theory of history, which means no one's responsible for anything, or there is a continuity in history. Without going into this, taking a mundane example, those that reject any concept of conspiracy in history must, for example, reject that the famous assassination of Julius Caesar wasn't planned at all, that in fact on that famous morning that he was stabbed to death by his colleagues, they presumably were just taking a stroll and haphazardly came across Caesar and quite spontaneously said, "There's Caesar, let's stab him." There'd be no planning, no plotting, nothing at all. It's a very important question to understand either the human drama is shaped by groups and people with long-term strategies, or it is simply village idiot stuff, in which case there's nothing anybody can do about anything. The truth is that if we look at this whole subject, we do see there is conspiracy. One of his famous, but not very well publicized except by organizations like the League, Sir Winston Churchill, in describing the Bolshevik Revolution in an article back in 1920 in a British journal, describes this worldwide conspiracy of these malevolent types with criminal records and backgrounds, and even dared to say that most of them were atheistic Jews. There was a conspiracy. They'd combined together, had planned together to achieve a certain objective. And this is one of those questions which those that want to understand the state of the world have got to come to grips with. The League's contribution was by making available information concerning long-term programs rooted in philosophies and drawing attention to the various groups that were associated with those programs. So it's not without interest that when in 1963 I gave a paper at a Melbourne League of Rights seminar entitled "The Fabian Socialist Contribution to the Communist Advance," which was carefully documented and has been published and republished right around the English-speaking world and some of the rest of the world, was simply a contribution to understanding one part of a movement which had adopted different tactics to advance an overall strategy. That book was subsequently brought to the attention of Mr. Liebler, and it's rather interesting that Mr. Liebler, who was posing as an anti-communist, although primarily concerned, he said, with the state of the Jews, in the Soviet Union dismissed it as evidence of Eric Butler's conspiratorial mania. In other words, here you get a clear understanding. In spite of the fact that a number of prominent anti-Zionists, men like Dr. Alfred Lilienthal of the United States and many others, have drawn attention to the fact that the Zionist movement itself is a striking manifestation of a long-term strategy, long-term planning, which you can only call conspiracy, in which large numbers of non-Zionist Jews on many occasions were blackballed or smeared and attacked in other ways because they would not take part in that program. That was 1963. The League continued to expand its influence, as we have said. 1965, there appeared that remarkable little work, been out of print for a long time, many years, Voice of Hate by D.K. Gott. Mr. Gott was a senior journalist at the time, been a member of the Communist Party. 1956, in face of the brutal invasion of Hungary, which no one could shut their eyes about and say that the Soviet wasn't brutal, but he then became a prominent Fabian socialist. He felt very comfortable there with Fabian socialism. D.K. Gott was engaged by Mr. Liebler and his fellow Zionists to write this book. It was a hatchet work on the League, mainly concerning myself. All we need to say about Voice of Hate is that it was full of errors of fact. It was a smear and hatchet project. And we do know that a number of printers in Melbourne were rather chary about handling it because they felt it might encourage some sort of litigation. There's little doubt that some of it did warrant, in one sense, litigation. But my view has always been never to get into that field where you may win in the short term but lose in the long run. So the League's reaction to Voice of Hate was simply to purchase large numbers of them and make them available as evidence of the sort of campaign that was being run against us. And we reached that quite remarkable situation, where the League of Rights had the only supply of Voice of Hate and was providing them. Mr. Liebler still keeps quoting the Voice of Hate as the great classic concerning the League of Rights, although other works have been produced, smear works, since then, but nevertheless, this is the one they keep quoting, Voice of Hate by Mr. D.K. Gott, who again emerged on the Australian political scene openly at the time of the great land rights campaigns, in which again the League was very much involved. In fact, so much involved that the Labor government engaged Mr. Gott to prepare a report on the League, to investigate the League. And he was engaged for 6 months, a contract job, $55,000 paid for the work, and no report has ever been discovered. So Mr. Gott obviously was a chosen and favored person, and he is the person that even well-known journalist, Mr. Philip Adams, drew heavily upon in some of his smearing articles and has referred to him as his good mate, Mr. Gott. Mr. Gott made the remarkable statement that Mr. Butler has done more to give aid and comfort to the Communist Party than he has to weaken it. Which doesn't explain then why the Communist movement itself enthusiastically took up Voice of Hate and heavily publicized it. We could go on, but it's not necessary, and we're merely trying to follow through an ongoing campaign. We come right down to suggestion in the federal parliament. There should be an all-party investigation into the league. And again, we had some remarkable suggestions made about that. One of the driving force behind that campaign, the Labor member from Queensland, Mr. Wright, whose subsequent course had to be sent to jail for his interference with young girls and much else. We don't need to dwell on that, except we could ask the question how Mr. Wright found himself in this position, as he himself at one time had been associated with the league. In fact, he took up one issue. In Queensland, the league had been advocating state banking, and it can be stated here that as an example of the league's influence, his address on state banking in the Queensland Parliament was actually written by a league supporter. We can only draw our own conclusions to why he undertook this campaign. In all of this campaign against the league and what it stands for, the subject of anti-Semitism, so-called, has run through it. And as we've progressed, we've now reached this remarkable situation, and I want to just stress this because I believe it's most important we get our minds around it, that we have a number of prominent academics and others who are promoting the concept that what allegedly was the greatest manifestation of anti-Semitism, namely the alleged liquidation of millions of Jews in gas chambers during the Second World War, had its roots in the Christianity of the New Testament. And there's been a build-up of a campaign progressively designed to create the impression it's Christianity which has been responsible. This is a very subtle campaign, but it's a deadly campaign, so deadly that in fact we have a number of Christian so-called church leaders now in retreat, many cases openly apologizing for the alleged anti-Semitism of the Christian church over 2,000 years, and allegedly for being the roots of what took place, or allegedly took place during the Second World War. We won't go into the subject of what's called the Holocaust here, except briefly to say it's been elevated into a new type of religion. It can't be discussed in any objective sense with many people. It's simply a question of faith. It's no good bringing forward all the arguments to show the story is very, very badly flawed. To bring forward the documentation that it could not have taken place on the scale mentioned, and certainly not mass gassing, it's a question now of faith. This is, according to the proponents of this, is the greatest disaster in human history, and the Christians are responsible for it, and they must repent. This has forced the Christian church and those who believe in Christianity into a position where they've got to reassess their whole situation. Because there's talk we should rewrite the New Testament, there are statements there, for example, about the Pharisees and other groups, spiritual forerunners of modern Judaism, that should be rewritten because this is the roots of the trouble. What the League has done as a Christian-oriented body is to draw attention to the problem and to suggest that a realistic defense of Christianity requires we face the facts, search out the truth, and present the truth. And that, of course, is what the League has been attempting to do and still is doing. It's now become the major battlefield for the future of the world. Because in essence, if Christianity is going to retreat from its historic position, particularly concerning the New Testament and what Christ taught and his clash with those who held a very different philosophical view, you might say the elevation of the collective over the individual, unless this question is faced by the Christians, then the Christians are faced with extinction. They are faced with defeat. That is what the League of Rights sees as the major battleground that we've now moved to. And it requires courage to face it. The League is providing information, it provides speakers, its influence is certainly extensive. But we don't deny the fact that this is a tremendous campaign now, which has Christians in the main on the retreat. And therefore, we need some sort of regeneration of Christianity and Christian faith and going back to its roots if we are to survive into the future.